You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, you're listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Many thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the past couple of hours, but now, at just past noon, it's time for Bums on Seats, the show that would never drink its Dom Perignon above 38 degrees, and always has one hand on the ejector seat button, just in case. My name is Mark Liversidge, and today I'm joined by reviewers Emma Marchant.
Hi there.
Jack Toy.
Hello.
And new reviewer Ashley.
Hello.
Our next hour of reviewing is an unlikely combination of troubled men and deprived women, mixing the historic with histrionics. At the male end of the spectrum, we have Daniel Craig's latest test drive of an Aston Martin Inspector, and Bradley Cooper going full Ramsay in cooking drama Burnt. For a female perspective, we catch up with the historic campaigners of Suffragette and follow the fortunes of an Irish girl trying to make her way in Brooklyn. Plus, we catch a glimpse of the ins and outs of modern movie marketing as we talk to representatives of Warner Brothers, Peccadillo Pictures and New Wave Films about the problems of getting new films seen in a saturated market. But before all that, we're heading down Mexico way.
You had no authority. None. Mexico City. What were you doing there?
I was taking some overdue holiday.
So what's going on, James? They say you're finished.
What do you think?
I think you're just getting started.
Tell me where he is.
He's everywhere.
You should go there. You're crossing over to a place where there is no mercy.
You're protecting someone.
Why should I trust you?
Because right now, I'm your best chance of staying alive.
Since its gritty reboot in 2006, the James Bond series has cleverly shifted itself from preposterous adventurers ripe with innuendo to something approaching prestige cinema. 2012 Skyfall, directed by Sam Mendes, even swapped the iconic Bond theme for a scene where the spy ran to the rescue to a reading of Tennyson. Now Spectre, the 24th film in the franchise, continues this modern mix of highbrow and low punches. Once again directed by Sam Mendes, Spectre opens with Daniel Craig's Bruiser Bond wreaking havoc on a rogue mission in Mexico City. Back in the UK, Bond is not only suspended from duty, but finds the 00 division facing closure in favour of cutting-edge and all-seeing technology. But Bond, following a mysterious lead sent from a ghost of his past, heads to Italy to the funeral of the man he killed in Mexico and starts tugging at the strings that may have been controlling his destiny all along. Emma, Spectre seems to have all of the requisite Bond elements in place, but did it have you paying attention?
Yes, it did. Bond is always kind of difficult to review because you can review it within many different structures. You can review it within the whole Bond canon. You can review it within this kind of mini Bond canon of the Daniel Craig Bonds. And certainly there is a lot that happens in Spectre that have me desperately scrabbling in my memory for connections to Skyfall, because it is completely a companion piece, and there's so much that goes on, particularly towards the end, that's tied into Skyfall. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's been rightfully praised, that incredible opening scene in Mexico City, which just maybe it doesn't quite reach those levels again. But it takes you to some glamorous locations. Daniel Craig, he seemed to be having a little more fun with the role this time. It's definitely a little less intense and I won't say po-faced exactly, but it's not as serious as Skyfall. There's definitely a little bit more Roger Moore, which, of course, I always love being a Roger Moore Bond girl. There's a little bit more of that cheesiness. But I felt this film was really carried by the MI6 supporting cast. I think Ralph Fiennes is some genius casting as you know, M2, having lost Judi Dench so emotionally in the last one. I thought Andrew Scott, you know, best known probably as Moriarty in the Sherlock Holmes, as the kind of new young boss about town, he was excellent. And Ben Whishaw, I could watch him all day as Q. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, Q is, I'm going to say Ben Whishaw for next Bond. Just promote Q to Bond, maybe. But my issue with it was, I have to say, Lea Seydoux as the main Bond girl, I'm sorry, I don't get her. I've just said it. I think she's just a bit, the whole thing was just a bit dead to me. Dead behind the eyes, no chemistry between them, so I couldn't really get behind that. But I think as a addition to the Bond canon, it works. It works within that.
Ashley, you were saying before we came on air that you've only come to the Bond series at Daniel Craig. So as a relative newcomer, how was it for you?
I've only ever known Daniel Craig as a Bond, never seen any proper, in inverted commas, Bond films. But he fits for me totally, that having never seen anyone else, that's easy to say. But I look at him and I think, yeah, you're exactly who you're supposed to be as my Bond. I totally get him as a choice. He's only doing one more. I'd happily watch him in more than that. But definitely what we were saying about the supporting cast, Ben Whishaw, adorable. He was my favourite thing in it. Sad, they kind of sold it on the older Bond lady. She wasn't in it very much at all. I missed her. She was great, and then is replaced by the blonde dead behind the eyes.
In terms of what the core of the film is, it's brought back for the first time in quite some time due to the issues over rights, Spectre itself as an organisation. So did the big Bond threat that's been in the films over the years live up to its billing, Jack?
It was a bit funny, wasn't it? A film about an organisation that can hack into everyone's phones, everyone's computers and control stuff, and you don't mention America, Russia or China anywhere. Like, you know, in the old Bonds of old days, it'd be Russia sitting at a table. Are we allowed to say that there's a twist of the characters? We can say there's Spectre. There's Spectre. Maybe there's a twist. Who knows? Go to the cinema and find out. I enjoyed it, and I think for teenagers watching it that haven't seen some of the classic Bonds, it'll be a nice introduction to that organisation. But I felt like the web of we've been controlling all of Daniel Craig's Bond franchise since the start was a bit tenuous.
I have to admit that James and I were talking about it, and we did say afterwards, it's so reverential back to old Bond films. There are so many kind of little visual bits and pieces that do reflect back to some of Sean Connery's Bonds, to Roger Moore Bonds. You know, there's a cracking fight scene on the train, which is very reminiscent of
Octopussy?
Is it for Russia with Jaws, basically? Heavy, who's played by the guy from Guardians of the Galaxy, is very much a Jaws-like character.
I mean, there's a couple of references there. You've got the fight with Jaws on the train from The Spy Who Loved Me, but it felt more referential to the fight with Red Grant, who was played by Robert Shaw in From Russia with Love, which is my favourite Bond film, which is why it's a callback for me. Bit of a Bond geek for listeners who probably hadn't worked that out already. But that scene is prefaced by a scene where he's talking to Lea Seydoux on the train, which feels almost like the scene on the train with Eva Green from Casino Royale.
Yes.
And it feels like you can't walk 2 minutes in the film without something trying to refer back to a previous Bond film. Is it now getting too stuck in this formula of nostalgia and repetition?
We were wondering, and it's actually interesting that Ashley said that she's only seen the Daniel, because we were wondering, how it's playing to people who haven't got this kind of canon of knowledge. Like, you know, I'm 42, so yeah, I grew up with Bond films. My parents, you know, get so excited every time a Bond film comes out, and they're in their 70s. Because, you know, they've been... When did Dr. No come out?
62.
So that is now 53 years ago, or whatever. So the new generation, I don't know. I don't know if there is too much harking back, or if that's kind of enjoyable, because Bond is so much part of our... You know, so much ingrained in our senses that you'd know it anyway, even not having seen them.
Yeah, I think you need all that harking back for people like your parents to keep them engaged. So they'll be like, oh, I recognise that from here. That's just like there. Because I think they might be turned off by the fact that it's pretty much sci-fi these days. It's not even good old action. It's completely non-believable in many places. So to keep the original audience engaged, I think they need to do them a solid and chuck in all of those references, because I think they just would not like it. It's unrecognisable, I think.
We're now living in a weird alternate universe where they built a different MI6 building across the river from the one which they blew up in Skyfall. So the whole thing is becoming weirdly sci-fi now. Jack.
I was going to say, something I thought worked really well and was woven extremely well into the fabric of this film was the Bond song, which I thought, on initial listen on the radio and on YouTube, I thought, it doesn't really go anywhere. What's the point? And then in this film, Sam Smith's Writing on the Wall song is the tone of the film. Refrains keep cropping up, that opening refrain where it goes da 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 da, and it is somber and it's melancholy, and I think it works really well. Thumbs up for this song, and I like to be impressed by something which I think I've heard, and then you hear it in a new light in context.
We talk about the Bond elements, and obviously that's one you have to tick off the list of getting a decent theme tune in there. Also, to get the score in there, Thomas Newman scoring, because he always scores for Sam Mendes films. To me, it felt that there were a couple of moments where there were big opportunities to bring in the big John Barry, Monty Norman Bond theme, which it stepped over. It didn't go down that route. Maybe it didn't feel Bondy enough to me. Is that a fair criticism?
I don't think so. In fact, funny enough, I was going to disagree a little bit with Ashley to say, of course, Sam Mendes is... There's been a lot of talk as well about how Sam Mendes does not like to use a lot of computer-generated imagery, CGI. He likes to do old-fashioned stunts, and the list of stuntmen at the end of this goes on for kind of pages and pages and pages. And that's apparently why the budget's so high. They take a long time to film because, you know, he really is a believer in... And I think that the action scenes did feel quite old school in a good way. And I think, you know, you spend a lot of time watching now other blockbuster franchises, if you like the Avengers and you know, and this had a more rough and ready, real feel about some of the action. I think it was definitely Bond enough. You had a lair, you had a train, you had a car chase around Rome, it was definitely Bond enough.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the lair, and without spoiling too much, Spectre was really first introduced in Bond films of the 60s, in particular in You Only Live Twice, which is the first time we saw Blofeld facially on screen with Donald Pleasance, with a big Japanese volcano lair with thousands of henchmen running around. And it's safe to say that this is a smaller scale Spectre by some
Cameron's Britain.
Even though it's in the deserts of wherever it is. I can't remember because it's so globetrotting.
Tangiers, I believe. They're in Tangiers, aren't they? But where they take their train to, I don't know.
Well, I mean, this is another point, that it's 2.5 hours. It's the longest Bond film ever. And there's a point when they get to Tangier and they're effectively sat waiting in the middle of the desert for a lift to come and pick them up to take them to the evil Spectre base. Is it too long?
Yeah, I was sort of waiting for thinking it was the final half hour, and then I was there for another hour. But that's just a pet hate of mine. If you can't do your job inside of 90 minutes, you're a bad director.
Oh.
But I don't want to sit there for 2.5 hours. I've had a little nap during the chasey, findy. Oh, there's a guy I need to kill. Oh, I nearly killed you, but I didn't. I didn't need that bit. You get it.
I am surprised. You telling me it's the longest Bond film, that surprises me, because Skyfall felt longer to me. I thought this clipped along at a decent pace. I wouldn't ever say within 90 minutes, but it's a pet hate of mine that a lot of films go on too long, and I feel I could often be shaved by like 10 or 15 minutes. But in this case, actually, I didn't look at my watch, and I felt it was pretty briskly paced.
They cut 25 minutes out of it to get it down to from a 15 to a 12A certification-wise. It only got certified 3 days before the release. We were kind of panicking at the cinema, like, why are we still having it spec to TBC? Without giving away the ending of the film, explicitly what happens, I really enjoyed the ending of this film, because on Her Majesty's Secret Service manner, it's the most uplifting of the Daniel Craig Bond endings, which I thought was really positive, and you don't always need to have...
Because a lovely Ben Whishaw.
Yeah.
I agree. That brought me back to those Roger Moore Bonds, where actually... And it doesn't have... We have... You know, Bourne is coming back again or whatever, if you want to talk about... You know, there was a lot of talk when the first Daniel Craig Bond came out about how Bourne-like it was, and it's catching up with the noughties, and this is how it should be. But, you know, we have other franchises to do tough, rough, gritty spy stuff. Bond, I think, should be Bond.
A little more campy.
Yeah, I think so. A little more fantasy, if you like. Fantastical.
Certainly fantasy.
I think we're probably all in agreement that Bond's definitely got its own identity. It's well established here. Mm-hmm. I'm probably going to try and take a bit more at the action scenes again, because for me they just felt undercooked. We've compared there to Bourne, we've compared to Mission Impossible. If you look at the last Bourne film, jumping through windows, running around Waterloo Station, that was the last Matt Damon Bourne film. We'll ignore the Jeremy Renner one for now. It's probably best for everyone concerned. If you look at the Mission Impossible film from this summer with Tom Cruise yet again doing a ridiculous array of his own stunts, here you get things like the car chase, where I don't really feel I can spoil much because almost nothing happens. He's on the phone to Moneypenny for most of it. Actually, for $300 million, whatever the budget was, is there enough on screen? Supposedly that scene wrecked 7 Aston Martins. I'm not seeing that on screen. Was there enough action to justify Bond's status as a leading action film?
I think he reckons, the director, I think, that he could have leaned on the WWE guy he brought here. He's like, I've got a professional wrestler in here. He's going to carry everyone. And he doesn't, really. He's given quite a big role. He's not a proper actor. He is a professional wrestler, so it's kind of niche. The Hinks guy,
that's the guy from Guardians of the Galaxy, yeah, Dave Bautista, who is Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy. I enjoy him in Guardians of the Galaxy a lot. I've already said what I felt about the action scenes, and I disagree with you, Mark. I think there was enough action. I think, and particularly, you know, I am clearly a woman, obviously, so maybe I'm not so desperately interested in seeing a big action film. I wanted to see a Bond film. I just could have done with better Bond women. I really agree with Ashley. Yeah. There was so much hoo-ha about Monica Bellucci, and honestly, blink
wasted,
and you would have missed her.
And she is fantastic.
Yeah, and you know, in Leia Seydoux, for whatever fault it is, maybe the part is underwritten. It just didn't work.
It also felt to me like it's a return to some of the slightly seedier misogynism of some of the Bonds. I mean, GoldenEye 95 was almost self-critical of the Bond films, of the Bond becoming this sexist, misogynist dinosaur. Here, again, without trying to spoil too much, the women in the Bond film are pretty much dropping at the feet of Daniel Craig. He seems to have to do very little. He seems to just walk into a room and they're all over him. And that to me felt stepping away from this realism that the series had tried to ground itself in, back to that male fantasy of the 60s and 70s Bonds.
I think Skyfall was more misogynistic, though. I think the treatment of the women in Skyfall was appalling, to be honest, and this at least does not have that. Yes, they're a little bit wallpaper, and you know, they're not particularly, like I said, Monica Bellucci is just, it's almost a cameo, really. But no, I felt, compared to Skyfall, I felt much more positive about this.
So this maybe is a factor of the same writers. So we had John Logan, Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, who all had a hand in writing Spectre. Neil Purvis and Robert Wade have been on the series pretty much since the start of the Pierce Brosnan era. Is it time to freshen things up a little bit? Do we need the same people keep coming back, or is it time for yet another reinvention in the style we've had a couple of times in the past 20 years?
It'd be a bit weird to totally reinvent it for Daniel Craig's last one, I think, if you look at it like an era.
Is he confirmed he's doing one?
He's contractually obliged, I think, by Sony
to do stay five. With him.
Yeah, for five. But, you know, like, it's odd to see, like, young Sean Connery in, like, Doctor No, and then you see him in Never Say Never Again, and he's like an 80-year-old running around. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't need to have...
There is perhaps a difficulty in this. It's been 3 years since the last one, and you think it's going to be another 3 or 4 years until the next one, then, you know, Daniel Craig will by that point be over 50. And at what point, like you say, does it become slightly icky, for want of a better word, to see him being paired with, you know, young Bond girls in their kind of late 20s or whatever? I would be quite happy for Daniel Craig to have signed off on this and then to have a reboot with a new Bond, but, you know, obviously it's not up to me.
Well, I'm sure we'll be back here in 3 years talking about whether it's Daniel Craig or Idris Elba or Emma Thompson, whoever is cast to play the next Bond. For now, you can see Spectre on pretty much every flat service available, including most cinemas. It opened last week and it's a certificate 12A. Our second film of the show is another British film showcasing a wealth of talent. Written by Abby Morgan, directed by Sarah Gavron, and with a star-studded cast, Suffragette is, amazingly enough, the first film to depict the struggles of women's suffrage in Edwardian Britain. Kerry Mulligan stars as Maud Watts, a fictional construct among many real-life names of the suffrage movement. Maud works at an industrial laundry with husband Ben Whishaw, but while he enjoys a certain leniency, the brutal conditions and abusive management give the women employees a short life expectancy. When Romola Garai's well-to-do politician's wife encourages the factory women to speak out, Maud and a co-worker, played by Anne-Marie Duff, confront the decision-makers of Parliament. After she witnesses the injustice firsthand, Maud becomes increasingly drawn into the movement, joining forces with Helena Bonham Carter's determined pharmacist and Emily Pankhurst herself, played in a cameo by Meryl Streep.
You work at the laundry?
Part-time from when I was 7, full-time from when I was 12. We meet Mondays and Thursdays if you're interested.
You a suffragette, Mrs. Ellen?
I consider myself more of a soldier.
As Mrs. Pankhurst says, it's deeds, not words, that will get us the vote.
We've identified weaknesses in their ranks. We're hoping one of them will break.
They're saying she's to speak.
This is a deliberate escalation. This has to stop.
For 50 years, we have labored peacefully to secure the vote for women. We've been ridiculed, battered, and ignored.
Punish those responsible, whatever way you can.
Mama!
All my life, I've done what men told me. Well, I can't have that anymore.
Jack, we originally didn't review Suffragette because it had already been out for a fortnight by the time of the last show, but here it is, almost a month since general release, and the film is still packing them in. Does it get your vote?
There's been one period drama with Kerry Mulligan in this year which I really liked, and Suffragette isn't that film. That was far from the madding crowd. I think Suffragette is a film about a radical subject matter, but is not a radical style of filmmaking and is kind of hackneyed and kind of dreary, kind of droll. I guess it goes to show that you can have as good a cast as you want on a poster, and if it doesn't grab you, it just doesn't grab you, and you can still get thousands of people coming in to see it. So would you like to know why I don't think it's particularly good?
That would be lovely.
I don't well, then I'll tell you.
Excellent.
I don't feel like I'm seeing anything here using the medium of cinema that really kind of describes the tale of the women's suffrage movement. And I think I know why. It's because they're trying to condense, I think there was something like 40 or 50 women's suffrage groups back in the day, and they're trying to condense all elements from all of these different groups into this one homogenous blob, kind of market it as Meryl Streep does Margaret Thatcher's voice as Emily Pankhurst, and she's in it. She's like the Monica Bellucci of the film, in a way. She's in it for 30 yeah. seconds, and she's like, yeah. Oh, go forth and trash a load of places. She disappears, and then it's just, it feels, it feels like homogenised milk.
How is Ben Whishaw in it? He's in it.
And it's embarrassing, really. Oh. I mean, I kind of...
I wouldn't go as far as embarrassing. I think it relies an awful lot on close-ups of Carey Mulligan looking sad. I felt that. I really did. I was like, good Lord, if I see one more picture of, like, Carey Mulligan's kind of, you know, pitiful face. And you're right. It's written. Every character in it just seems to be a cipher for a person. So you have the poor Cockney woman who keeps getting pregnant. That's Anne-Marie Duff with maybe a slightly abusive husband. You have Carey Mulligan as, you know, the kind of one who becomes almost radicalised by seeing how awfully her boss treats people in her
right,
pop
so
work.
Ben Whishaw can't portray a dominant threatening husband, can he? Even with his Freddie Mercury moustache,
no.
He is not going to intimidate me to go and rescue my child from his manly grips. I'd let him get me with his manly grips, but if I needed
cheap.
To... Yeah. Sorry.
Sorry, this is obviously because, like you said, we're reviewing this because it is surprisingly... Well, not surprisingly, because there is very little choice on, obviously. When Spectre comes in, has dominated the screen, and we'll be moving on to Burnt later. Suffragette is... And it is, again, I went to go and see it with my parents, because my mother was very interested. And it's just a shame that it doesn't... You know, one of the quotes on a film poster, I think, is finally the suffragettes get the film that they deserve or whatever. And you're like, well, they've never... that's a terrible quote anyway. But also, I don't think there's been a serious film really made about the suffrage movement. They have tried with this, so it's worthy for sure. And you can't be too rude about it because it is trying to make a real, a decent film about something that was, you know, is a very interesting part of our history. But it just doesn't... ever capture you.
Do you feel you actually learned anything about the suffrage movement you didn't know before going in?
It's more about policing standards in those days, really, isn't it? It shows that the policing forces don't really change in their methods of infiltration.
I learned more about working in a laundry, perhaps, than, you know, in the East End of London in the 1910s than I did before. But no, not really anything about suffrage.
I mean, I think... Full marks to Sarah Gavron, the director, for attempting to tell this tale, but really a film like this, with the subject matter like this, demands someone like Derek Jarman. He's dead, but a film like a radical filmmaker to portray a radical subject matter. It doesn't do to have a subject matter like this washed over in like a BBC Sunday drama kind of. It's a bit...
Does it have to be radical, though? Is it not enough just to lay out the facts of the story?
They were putting bombs in post boxes, and they were trying to, like, tip over the king's horse at a race. That's it. That's in these days, that would be worse than the IRA, wouldn't it, I guess?
So do you feel we not got a sense of what the context of that was in the period then? Just how dramatic their actions were?
It just tried to be, and I think also the problem is with the script, really. The script, it was not particularly exciting or emotionally charged, and it should have been emotionally charged. I mean, there are some terribly, you know, some awful things happen, and, you know, Carrie Mulligan does say, you know, it's traumatic what happens to her as a mother, I would say. That's a terrible, terrible thing that happens to her, for her as a mother in the film. And I didn't really, and I am one to often get emotionally washed away by films, and I just never really connected with this. And it's no fault of the cast. Brendan Gleeson is great. Helena Bonham Carter is pretty good. Carrie Mulligan is a fine actress, and Jack, I absolutely loved her in Far From the Madding Crowd. She's, you know, I think she's a glorious actress, and I think she's so talented, but she just wasn't given a lot to do.
We have a question from an avid listener, Mr. T. Miller of Saffron Walden, who is interested to know if we think this is a trend in British filmmaking that's become a bit safe with the likes of The Imitation Game. I would even say Spectre to a certain point. A bit of safe British filmmaking.
How can you have films like 71 and, is it The Hunger? The Steve McQueen one, about the struggles in Ireland, fairly recent history, and they feel like they've captured it perfectly, and yet for a similar kind of radicalised subject matter like this 100 years ago, you can't have a similar style of filmmaking.
I think Emma Marchant thinks, I think this is appealing to the Grey Pound. That's what I think it is. I think after the best Marigold Hotel or whatever was such a phenomenon, and people realise that there are many, you know, the Grey Pound is a real phenomenon. We have an ageing population who are staying.
I've got grey hairs now.
As have I. Yeah. Not very many pounds, though. So I do think that a lot of these films are trying to be, are being marketed to appeal to an older crowd who perhaps don't want to see radical. They want to see faces they recognise telling stories they know. Maybe that's patronising towards an entire generation of people. I don't mean to be, but it's just a thought.
You know, the most radical part of this film is the end credits where they list the chronologically which countries and when they allowed the women to have the votes. That's the most...
Switzerland, 1971. Yeah.
That's the most shocking part of the film. And it's just text. It's more. It could be the opening of Star Wars.
Yeah.
Just before we wrap up on this one, we've not found too many positives in this. For me, probably the best thing about it was the confrontations between Kerry Mulligan and Brendan Gleeson, who is the slightly sympathetic policeman. Do we feel that there were maybe some good performances in there to be had?
We had the historical advisor in the cinema for a film education screening a few weeks ago, and apparently in the original edit of the film, there was going to be a scene where he then goes to Her Majesty or to whoever it is and resigns because he can't keep arresting suffragettes, and he decides to resign in like allegiance with them, but then they cut it out, and it just
that's quite significant.
Yeah. I think they were good, but I said that I think the performances are good. It's just perhaps the script and yeah, like you say, the direction just perhaps didn't give it the oomph and the grit and the emotional heft it deserved.
So, not a big X in the box from the Bums on Seats team there. Suffrage opened almost a month ago, but it's still screening all three Cambridge cinemas, and it's a Certificate 12A.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats, Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. It's this time of year that the cinema schedule begins to resemble an overstuffed suitcase, as the usual box office contenders compete with eager award contenders for a fickle audience. Notice how both Suffragette and Spectre opened on a Monday to beat the rush and clamour of a Friday opening. And these big films, with their marketing dollars and chat show-friendly stars, can easily stampede the smaller films underfoot. To get an idea of the difficulty of releasing smaller films, and the landscape for larger movies, earlier this year, regular Bums on Seats host Toby Miller sat down with three people working in UK film distribution. Ollie Charles, comms manager at Peccadillo Pictures, who specialise in LGBT cinema, and released films such as The Brilliant Stranger in the Lake, Louise Page, Warner Brothers' original marketing executive for Deluxe Film, and Dana Bakerman from New Wave Films, whose most recent release was Taxi Tehran. They spoke about the number of new films released per week and the issues raised by the increasingly long running times of films. But first, Toby asked if Ollie from Peccadillo thought it was tricky for distributors to find new audiences.
We're quite lucky sometimes because we have a very specific niche of working with LGBT cinema. So there's an audience potentially, I'm not saying it's 100%, but potentially pre-built for that film already. There are opportunities for those films to break out into the mainstream, and that is when we then have to obviously work in different respects per film to try and find what that audience is. Yes, it's difficult, and it is a matter of focusing on what are the themes of this film, who's going to watch this film, what's the audience, and they could be a variety of ages, etc., etc. And we have to work to find them.
My name's Louise Page, and I'm the Warner Brothers Regional Marketing Executive for Deluxe Film. Every film we release pretty much is different, and although we do have some of them that fit a similar genre, this year's a little bit different for us because all of the things that we are releasing are new. Although Mad Max is a recognised franchise, it was over 30 years ago that the last film released, so lots of people won't have heard of it. So this year's exciting because we are looking for new audiences. I would say it's a case of finding the right cinema to target. So obviously Picture House for some of them like Cake, but also then we have the bigger films that work in the multiplex cinemas. And then also the location, because sometimes films don't work in an area. So for example, Ironclad, which was quite a small film we released across about 20 cinemas in the UK, and that only worked in big cities. So it depends on the location as well.
How would you go about marketing something like, as you say, a film like Mad Max, which mm-hmm. which is basically a new franchise? Is it yes. just the actor aspect? Is there mm-hmm. the celebrity aspect in a way,
yeah.
or is it something as brute force as the car chases or something? How do you work out who the target and how when to target them?
Yeah, well, we'd look at similar types of films. So with Mad Max, you're looking at people like the Fast and Furious audience, and target them in ways that we've targeted them on previous releases. But like you said, the celebrity aspect is really important. And I think with these big blockbuster films that we release, you have to have a name on there because that's the recognisable person that people are going to come and see. And obviously, Tom Hardy playing Mad Max is a big, big benefit to us because he is very, very popular, particularly with the British audience as well. So that makes it a little bit easier to market.
Hey, rigged this. You lost a baby brother. Perfect in every way.
I had a baby brother. I had a little baby brother. And he was perfect. Perfect in every way.
Dana Blakeman from New Wave Films and Picture House. What Warner Brothers consider an indie film for us would be a blockbuster. So we go for more for the films, not that fall off the shelf, but the others bigger than us, our competitors haven't really picked up. And they're a very niche market, critically acclaimed. So we have a number of national journalists who are well known to us and our films and with our history, Artificial Eye. And we really rely on them to support our film, because without having a critically acclaimed film that's only going to pick 2-3 stars, we'd never be able to put them in the cinema. The main problem is getting them in the cinema. And if you have that support from the critics, then you're halfway there.
There is sort of an increasing prevalence for the length of these films. Is it increasingly difficult? Is there a slightly inward sigh when you see, oh no, he's made yet another 4-hour film, and how it's brilliant, it's a masterpiece, but this is going... Mm. Or do you actually have to end up using that as part of the marketing ploy?
I think the future of cinema has a lot longer films, and you're seeing, you know, the success of Boyhood. That's 3.5 hours long. Not many people complained about it, and they look at our films a bit differently. It's still a hard reach, a hard catch to put out a film that's so long, especially for programmers and exhibitors. But, you know, that is the future. Films are, fortunately or unfortunately, getting a lot longer. So it's not a huge, huge problem with our niche market, and the demographics are changing, older people with more time.
Is it becoming more prevalent? I mean, it doesn't seem like... Yeah, I've always sort, in some cases, I've always thought the length of the Hobbit films, for instance, was more generosity than anything else,
yeah.
rather than an attempt to make more money. In fact, it must make less money to an extent.
Yeah, strangely, yes, because obviously it means you get less viewings of the films, because as Dana said, the exhibitors can't fit in as many screenings, because if a film is 3 hours long, you know, if it's an hour and a half, they can show five times a day. If it's 3 hours long, they can only show two times a day. But I think we're trusting directors a lot more with their work. And I think directors have become celebrities, whereas, you know, a few years ago, directors weren't really celebrities. And people come to the cinemas to watch films made by certain people. And I think we've started to trust what those people are doing and allow them to make the masterpieces that they want to make rather than cutting them short.
There are so many. I'm a very, very low version of one of them, but there are so many people clamouring for content, and you're providing that content, whether it's in a director's interview or a review of the film. Is it just too much noise and you've got to sort of rein it in a little bit? Are there too many websites? There are too many bloggers and film reviewers now?
No, there's never enough. I think the online market is great for us because a lot of them are our market are students. The national press is still very important. If we put out a poster, we always get English quotes and hopefully in time, not the American trades. And so, you know, I think the more the better, but you obviously weed them out and get the best quotes and best interviews with the best journalists out there, if you can. So, yeah.
What about with Warners? Because obviously if in your area of film, there is so much and it must make your job almost nightmarish to an extent, the people that you can reach out to.
No, like Dana, I agree that the more the better for us. And obviously, again, yes, we do use the big national press and all of the big journalists and stuff on national stuff. But personally, I work locally and I work with local cinemas. So people like yourself in Cambridge, you're very important in this area. So it doesn't matter how big or small your company is. If you're talking about our film, we're happy. So we try our hardest to work with as many journalists as we possibly can.
I was going to say, it's an interesting question because, and I've not seen any of these films, so it might just be the fact that the films are just not good. But I think that, like, Grace of Monaco and Diana and those sorts of films, which obviously have huge names and a lot of preamble, once they're seen, the very first time they're seen at premieres, whether it's Venice or Cannes or Berlin or whatever, as soon as you have that initial press, if the press is one star throughout all of the reviews, which we saw for Grace of Monaco and Diana, it was, that I think will kill the film. So it goes to show, like what Dana was saying before, the power of the press is important. It's not, for me at least, it's not 100% of it, but it is important for certain films.
I don't know how I'm going to keep living with him. I don't know how I'm going to spend the rest of my life in this place where I can't be me.
Who is that? Grace Kelly, movie star? You invented her. You learned a certain kind of walk, and you perfected a certain kind of accent, and you did it beautifully. But now you're just a housewife with two bratty kids watching a rerun of your wedding day. It's not why you came here, Grace. You came here to play the greatest role of your life.
Talking about the marketing of the film, it used to be a salient point. When it was released, that was when you did all the marketing. It's becoming perhaps in the way that events are marketed, in that it's not quite a year-round thing, but it's becoming a year-round thing. And you mentioned that films can start to build a word of mouth before they're even in production.
Cinema is now an event. There was some research done into cinema figures, and they said that the problem with cinema goers, the decrease in potential cinema goers was down to things like the Olympics, down to things like the FA Cup, down to Strictly Come Dancing and the X Factor. That's event television, and so films are having to become events. We are, you know, it gone are the days, I think, where you can just rely on the fact that the film is in the cinema is enough. You have to work the film in ways that I don't think has happened before. There's 15 to 20 films coming out every single week in British cinema in this territory. We have more films coming out here than we do in Paris, in France, you know, and their cinema-going culture is incredible. It's ingrained from day one that you go to the cinema. But that doesn't happen here so much, and yet there's more competition. So we do. We have to market the films as soon as we've acquired them. You have to have a marketing brief meeting. How are we going to start talking about this film? How are we going to, even if it's just putting pictures on Facebook to start to tease your audience, how are we going to do that from day one? What are we going to do on release to make this an event? Do we bring a filmmaker over? Do we hold a party? I know, you know, these sound like small things that you may not consider, I suppose. But they are things that are now having to be really contemplated and thought on quite seriously to make the film stand out from the 19 other films that are coming out. And if you're working on a smaller budget as well, then how do you make your limited budget stretch in a way that's going to make your film with probably no one famous, probably not a particularly famous director that may have played in several festivals, but has probably that's about it. How do you make that stand out?
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Dana, Louise and Ollie for the interviews, and to the Cambridge Film Consortium for giving us the opportunity to talk to them. There's quite a bit we didn't broadcast of that interview, including on how critics both help and hinder film releases and the rise of popular documentaries, and all that will be in the podcast edition of this programme. More details of that at the end of the show.
105 Sport. Join us every Saturday afternoon as we take a closer look at what's happening in the world of sport.
Follow all the weekend's local and national sport in action, plus a focus on the sporting activities in the community.
Join the 105 Sport team every Saturday from 2 to 5pm.
On community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105. My name is Mark Liversidge, and with me today are Emma, Ashley and Jack. As you've just heard this afternoon on Cambridge 105, continues with 105 Sport, on air between 2 and 5 with the start of United's FA Cup campaign. Before that, there's another chance to hear the interviews Julian Clover and Liz Barker did with Ian Cumming, finalist and runner-up in this year's Great British Bake Off. So all sorts still to come. We've still another 20 minutes or so of the show left, including a review of Brooklyn. But before that, we're busy sharpening our knives.
At 16, I quit school. I saved just enough for a one-way ticket to Paris. Maybe I just wanted it really bad, and then when I got it too early, I didn't know how to hold on to it.
What do you want?
I'm gonna run the best restaurant in the world.
Are you sure he's famous?
If you're a chef, he's like the Rolling Stones.
I don't want my restaurant to be a place where you come and eat. I want people to sit at that table and be sick with longing.
So, where you been?
Louisiana.
Doing what?
Sniffing, snorting, injecting.
If you try to start a new restaurant, there are at least a dozen people who will try to have you killed.
The kitchen's the only place I've ever felt like I really belonged.
I loved every minute of it. The heat, the pressure, the violence.
With Gordon Ramsay as his executive producer and food consultants of the stature of Marcus Waring and Mario Batali behind the scenes, new cookery drama Burnt certainly arrives with a four-star culinary pedigree. Written, oddly enough, by Peaky Blinders and Locke creator and writer Stephen Knight, Burnt stars Bradley Cooper as Adam Jones, a chef of ferocious talent and volatile temper. After 3 years of self-imposed exile, Jones opens a high-end restaurant in London, helped by old friends, including Daniel Brühl's restaurant manager, old enemies such as Omar Sy's arch-rival, and a sprinkling of new talent in the form of Sienna Miller's new chef. With Emma Thompson's therapist keeping an eye on his flashpoints, Jones sets out in the search of the elusive goal of all top chefs, a three-star rating from the Diner's Bible, the Michelin Guide. Emma, Burnt has a collection of fine ingredients, but is it perfectly finished or just a collapsed souffle?
I have spent some time trying to think of a food analogy for this. Now, from the reviews and from the fact this has been slid into the, you know, the release schedule alongside Spectre, it's pretty obvious it was never going to be a Michelin-starred feast. However, I was hoping it might be like a bowl of crunchy nut cornflakes. Predictable, maybe a little bland, but, you know, not the worst thing in the world. It ended up being an unpleasant tin of out-of-date ravioli at the back of the... Honestly, it was... I am amazed that you have found a trailer without swearing in it, because the script from the guy who wrote What You Said and also wrote Dirty Pretty Things seems to think that just by having people screaming, "Yes, chef," and swearing continuously at one another stands in the way of a script. This obviously represents passion and anger and tempestuous, talented chefs. It just... I mean, the only thing I think that saves this from just being unwatchable is the fact that the cast and Bradley, I mean, Bradley Cooper is watchable. He does have a screen presence. I was excited about Daniel Brühl. Not really excited about Sienna Miller, I can't lie. You know, and then there's also Uma Thurman, Emma Thompson, Omar Sy, Matthew Rhys, who I like. His TV work, I think, is stellar, Matthew Rhys's, as his kind of, you know, as Bradley Cooper's rival chef. But it just goes nowhere. You never know what he did in Paris. It was so awful. You don't care what he did in Paris. You don't care about any of these people. There's no chemistry between him and Sienna Miller, and nothing happens. And the food looks like it was cooked in 1985. It's all kind of fussy Nouvelle cuisine, which feels now we're in 2015. It was terrible.
I think being slightly generous to it, to be honest, because I probably liked it less than you did, and that's saying something. I try to work out where to start with that lot. I think the first thing is the food. It seems to have no interest in the food. Now, I know you didn't like Chef, which we talked about on the show previously. For me, though, that film at least made you want to eat some food at the end of it. Whereas this, you could have taken the food out of the film completely and just had people standing around workbenches, and it would have made no real difference. Should a film like this be trying to sell you on what's at the heart of it, which is the passion, the love, the soul of the food?
It would have been selling me on something, I suppose. I mean, there's just so many awful lines now. At one point, Bradley Cooper says to Uma Thurman, who's playing a food critic, "I want you to help me kick this arrogant city's ass." And at that point, I was like, this is only about 10 minutes in. You're like, that's one of the worst lines I've ever heard. And if this is where we're going, it's not going to get any better. And there's a lot of faff about turbot, but they make the turbot look extremely unappealing anyway, even when it's meant to be cooked to perfection. It looks horrible. I don't know. I'd be interested as a kitchen, if any of us had worked in a professional kitchen, if that bore any resemblance to reality, maybe it does.
I swear at you, I've met one happy chef in my life.
Well,
everyone else is a very angry, scary man.
I've been to Happy Chef.
It felt like there was a certain, and I'm not, you know, the whole Gordon Ramsay thing, the fact he was an executive producer, there was times of this where it just did feel like I was sitting through the worst episode of Hell's Kitchen, which I hate anyway, just being shouted at by Gordon Ramsay, which is no one's idea of a fun time at the cinema.
Taking up the Gordon Ramsay thread, and just briefly to apologise if anyone was offended by Emma's Radio 4 level of swearing there, hopefully that was perfectly acceptable. But if you were offended,
didn't
apologies.
Didn't even realise, I'm very sorry.
It's what the film does to you, though. I mean, it's trying to turn Bradley Cooper into a Gordon Ramsay-type person, and for me, it just never. It feels like the last person you would want to cast as Gordon Ramsay is Bradley Cooper.
He doesn't have, you know, there is no real anger. You cannot believe, I think actually, yeah, you've probably hit the nail on the head. You cannot believe that Bradley Cooper did these terrible things in Paris. You never know exactly what they were, but they were bad enough that to tone at the very beginning, he is shucking a million oysters, and he just shucks his millionth oyster in Louisiana and then marches out, because that's it. He's like, and I have atoned. But what he's meant to atone for, you don't know, but you just don't believe, because Bradley Cooper is essentially seems like a nice guy. No matter how many swear words he throws at the screen, you just can't believe that he was that terrible.
But it also comes, I think, to problems with the script, that not only is everything in the film driven by what happened off screen, which you're either not told about in enough detail or told about in too much detail, with characters just standing around and throwing out globs of massive, horrible exposition, which just leaves the story stone cold. You know, it's set in a world that is maybe slightly impenetrable to people. It takes 45 minutes to try and explain this world to you, and by that point, it feels like people have lost interest. How did we end up with a script so poor from someone like Stephen Knight, who's written things like Peaky Blinders, Locke, which is a masterclass in not doling out too much exposition? How do we get
and
to this
And Dirty
point?
Pretty Things, which is a world, which I, you know, was a well-written film a long time ago, to be fair, but I have no idea. I don't know if it got doctored. I mean, like, again, there's a terrible scene with Matthew Rhys Bradley Cooper, when he says something like, "I'm just so fed up with this Mozart Salieri thing," or whatever, and you're like, "Oh, for goodness sake, that's some of the worst comparisons I've ever seen." Then he makes him an omelette, and Bradley Cooper goes, "This is good." And you're like, "Well, I would hope it's good. He's a 3-star Michelin chef. He can't make an omelette." Then we're really in a world of pain. It just, that kind of thing just turned it from being, like I said, what could have been maybe an innocuous hour and a half of entertainment just into something so awful. It's just sad this even gets space in the cinemas. It's sad it gets made. It's sad there's that much talent on screen. I don't get it.
For me, what summed it up is the one person you didn't mention in the cast list was Alicia Vikander, and apparently Harvey Weinstein included her in two scenes in the film which weren't in the original script just because he thought she's up and coming and it'd be nice to give her a job.
Her part is completely irrelevant. Yes. Irrelevant. She wears a nice coat.
I feel like we've just got material for the Bums and Seats sting from your rant there. We can use that for anything for the rest of the year.
I'm sorry. Anyway, I would say yes, please go and see anything else rather than this. And if you will, go and see Suffragette. You know, Suffragette is, you know, this makes Suffragette look like the most amazing, radical, exciting film in the world. It's horrible.
I really can't disagree with any of that, other than I think maybe you've just slightly undersold it in terms of how terrible it is. But if you are a masochist or a food fan who's not listened to a word we've said, then it opened yesterday, November the 6th, and it's now showing at both View and Light Multiplexes in Cambridge, and it's a certificate 15 for the swearing. Adapted by Nick Hornby from Colin Toybin's novel of 2009, Brooklyn has all the trappings of an old-fashioned epic, though its story remains as focused as a short story. Saoirse Ronan plays Ailish Lacey, an Irish girl who arrives in the New York of the early 1950s, determined to find the future she can't see back home in her parochial hometown. The golden opportunity she has heard about so much materializes a job in a department store and a bed in a lodging house. But life picks up when she falls in love with a young Italian-American by the name of Tony. But just as her new American life begins to take shape, Ailish is pulled back to Ireland.
Sponsored me. He found me a job.
They told you a date for the nylon sale at Ailish.
Oh, dear God.
I thank you to keep his name out of a conversation about nylons.
We need Irish girls in Brooklyn.
I wish that I could stop feeling that I want to be an Irish girl in Ireland.
I was glad to see you finally got some letters from home today.
I forgot to check.
They'll still be there after dinner.
Dear Rose, I think of you and Mother every single day. I have a boyfriend. He's sweet. He's funny. Tony has helped me to feel that I have a life here I didn't have before I met him.
Hello, Mammy.
Everyone's gone, Ailish. I have nobody.
How would it be for you if I did go home?
I'd be afraid.
Afraid that I wouldn't come back.
Ashley, Brooklyn runs the risk of descending into a whole array of stereotypes, but does it find a way to rise above that?
I don't think it's stereotypical at all. Yes, it's a romance film. That's the genre, so you can't say anything aside from that. But it's... I hate using the word lovely, but that is the best. It is lovely. It's very Nick Hornby. It's not quite as snappy and exciting and young and fun as maybe About a Boy. It's another Grey Pounder one, and Grand Dame of Julie Walters with a little cameo in there will satisfy everyone. I came in under the cover of darkness, but I think everyone else in the room was a couple of decades older. But I really hope younger people don't write this off, because it is a really lovely film with a young cast. It's a young love story about leaving your tiny little hometown, going out there, taking your first big steps out into the world. So it's for younger people, so I really hope people don't write it off as a Grey Pound film.
Jack, it's strange now that we think of someone like Saoirse Ronan as being an established actress when she's only 21. It's a long time since Atonement first brought her to our attention. Is she someone who'll help attract that younger audience to this film?
Definitely. I mean, she's fantastic. She is probably one of my most cherished young actors around there at the moment, I think. And I love a film when you think it's going to be complete pap and then you are extremely pleasantly surprised by what's at play in the story. It almost had, without the comedic elements, it almost had the complexities of a Woody Allen narrative where X fancies Y but also has Z and decides to play one off against the other, or do they even have to? It has a lot more going for it than your standard let's emigrate
to. It's really hard to explain the plot without downplaying it, because that is basically what goes on, but there's so much, and it's the opposite of the dead behind the eyes actors. There's so much going on in their faces and in their delivery, and you love everybody as well, so whichever way she swings at the end, I wouldn't have minded either way. I liked them both. I was really invested in everyone.
I think there's a shot early on in the film when Saoirse Ronan, she's on the boat going over to America, and she sees New York for the first time. The camera lingers on her face. She's not saying anything, and it's like you could watch that face for about a minute and the face is changing and you can see the internal processes going on. She's fantastic. I think she's got to be up for like an Oscar nod or something in this.
Yeah, this really would have fallen apart if any one character was badly cast, but everyone was exactly who they should have been. The writing is very good, but I don't think it wouldn't have stood up if we didn't have three brilliant people in
as girl A with her boy B and C.
We've got Montreal and some CGI standing in for 50s New York. Did it convincingly sell a period to you?
I think so. I'm always looking at the clothes, so no, definitely love. And the difference between Ireland and New York, sort of, they were very, very, very sentimental about Ireland. I'm surprised Nick Hornby isn't Irish himself, given how much he seems to love the country, because it's difficult to say there's nothing here. It's a bit of a hellhole. You've got to leave and go to New York. That's not what he was saying. It's a beautiful place. Everyone, if you look for the opportunities, you have them. But if you're young, you can go over to New York. It's not sort of escaping a grey, dreary, hellish island. It's a very cute little town she's from. Everyone's going out to dances in the nice dresses.
There's this parallel between her and her sister, because Saoirse's character, Ailish, gets the chance to go to New York, whereas her sister has to stay at home in Ireland and work. And so there's this really nice narrative trick where they're writing letters to each other and reading them out throughout the film, and you're kind of, as you would do in high school, comparing and contrasting the experiences of a young woman in the big city and young woman back at home in rural Ireland. And it works really well as a way to heighten this sense of excitement that being in New York, falling in love with someone from a completely different culture, like the Italian, it's the Italian tribe in Brooklyn who apparently don't get on very well with the Irish tribe, and yet romance blossoms.
Yeah. I was extolling the virtues of this to my mother on the phone before I came in this morning, and at one point she trotted out the cliche, they don't make films like this anymore. Mm-hmm. That to me probably feels like fair comment, but it's, I suppose, a question of why films like this don't get made anymore, and how this has managed to make what to me feels a very classic style of filmmaking. It feels like the simplistic quality, but still, you know, with layers to it, of films that we used to get but seem to have gone out of fashion.
I was thinking a little bit of Casablanca, because in Casablanca it's the kind of unrequited love, you can't quite get your romance because your partner or presumed partner is with someone else at that point. It has been done before many times, but
it's the old Romeo and Juliet, but it's these huge big blockbusters. I haven't seen an original one in about a decade, so they're doing it on the other side of the coin as well, so I don't know why more people don't pitch up to these sorts of very simple classic love stories. And I think maybe it's too big of a gamble. They're worried if Saoirse didn't work with Donal, and or not enough people are fans of theirs, you wouldn't get the audiences in. But it really worked this time, so it is a huge gamble. I think if one element's wrong, these films don't work.
Is it also fair to say that it's a very funny film? Always when I go to a film, and it's nice because you're in a cinema, you're hearing the investment of the audience, and certainly the audience I heard it with last night were very invested from the get-go. There's an awful lot of laughter in the first half of the film. Julie Walters, we mentioned her appearance, she is brilliant without descending into caricature.
She's a little bit character. She's doing a Julie Walters cameo for sure. I think that's what she was brought on and paid to do, definitely. I loved her
in it. It's good to see she got off the island, was it Mykonos in Mamma Mia? She managed to escape, and then she's time travelled back to Brooklyn and become a dour landlady.
She was great in it, no.
But it's a very sympathetic film as well. It's not that it feels like it's got the sort of rough edges taken off, but it feels like it's not trying to be controversial or melodramatic or too harsh at any point. It's just trying to tell an honest story. Would you say that's fair, Jack?
Yeah, I think that, and that's part of its charm. I mean, we're using all of these words which could be considered cliche, and yet the emphasis is it doesn't feel cliche, does it?
It's a cliche because it's true, but yeah, it does what it says on the tin. It's simple, it's lovely. Your mum will like it, Emma, when you take her. Definitely it's a mum film, but I really hope the young audience aren't turned off by it, because it's for us. It's a story about us, for us.
I mean, I'm always slightly concerned when I come to films like this, particularly when I see the poster quotes, and this just seemed to be heating the Daily Mail and a few others, but I think it transcends the demographic a bit wider than that. I suppose it's a question of, if we're trying to pitch it now to the young audience, how do we pitch it to try and encourage people, I say of our age, of your age, because you're both clearly a lot younger than I am.
It's, if you don't like action films where people punch each other and shoot up a whole cavalcade of cars, and miraculously the dead behind the girl's eye walks free, this is the sort of thing you want to be seeing. You will be entertained, you're invested, it is a good use of your time, it's not too long, everyone's
lovely in it.
I guess for a younger audience, we could say we've all been to New York, gone on Tinder and swiped right, and then we've had to fly back to London, swiped again, and shock, shock, horror, we're in love with two people.
This strikes me to be a very different film in the age of Tinder, probably over in about 10 minutes. Saoirse Ronan just done a few swipes and that was it, and life was sorted. Maybe there's, we talked about the nostalgia of Spectre, maybe there's the right kind of nostalgia here, that it's a tight, it's almost a, although you see a lot of hardship going for the film, there's a certain wistfulness for this almost romantic era of Brooklyn that the film sells.
Definitely, but that you don't even realise it's happening. You come out and think, oh my God, I love Ireland, I must move to Ireland, but do I want to move to Manhattan instead? You don't realise you're not spoon-fed this sort of winking at the camera, as we were saying, that Spectre does to you. It's subtle, but you get it, you get everything. It's not too clever over your head. It's just in the middle, it's perfect.
I think that's a very good note to leave it on. Brooklyn began its run at the Arts Picture House yesterday, and it's a certificate 12A. And that is all we have time for today. As always, a podcast of the show will be available in a couple of days from the Cambridge 105 website, with a few more minutes added to the marketing interview. And you can keep up with the shenanigans of Bums on Seats by befriending us on Facebook or following us on Twitter. In both cases, just search for Bums on Seats. We'll be back in a fortnight's time, 21st of November, with a show that catches the first of the award contenders for this autumn season. Lady in the Van is Alan Bennett's play, brought to prestigious Art House Cinema with Maggie Smith and Alex Jennings. Danny Boyle directs Aaron Sorkin with Steve Jobs, starring Michael Fassbender as Jobs, with a supporting cast that includes Kate Winslet and Seth Rogen. And Kate Winslet is also turning up in The Dressmaker. We're playing out with John Carpenter's theme to Assault on Precinct 13. Why, may you ask? Because the track is part of the eclectic score to Gaspar Noé's Love, which enjoys a very rare 3D screening at the Arts Picture House on November the 18th. Stay tuned for In Conversation with Ian Cumming, but from everyone here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Top of the morning to you.
Bye.